For 3 days and 3 nights, Wolf was engaged in a nearly ceaseless search for food. He slept from each dawn until just past noon, in a hollow he had discovered beneath the fallen trunk of an oak. Certainly Wolf did not feel himself imprisoned, despite Jack's forebodings. The woods on the other side of the field were extensive and full of a wolf's natural diet. Mice, rabbits, cats, dogs, squirrels, all these he found easily. He could have contained himself in the woods and eaten more than enough to carry him through to his next change. But Wolf was riding with the moon, and he could no more confine himself to the woods than he could have halted his transformation in the first place. He roamed, led by the moon, through barnyards and pastures, past isolated suburban houses, and down unfinished roads where bulldozers and giant asymmetrical rollers sat like sleeping dinosaurs on the banks. Half of his intelligence was in his sense of smell, and it is not exaggerating to suggest that Wolf's nose, always acute, had now attained a condition of genius. He could not only smell a coop full of chickens 5 miles away and distinguish their odors from those of the cows and pigs and horses on the same farm, that was elementary. He could smell when the chickens moved. He could smell that one of the sleeping pigs had an injured foot, and one of the cows in the barn an ulcerated udder. And this world, for was it not this world's moon which led him, no longer stank of chemicals and death. An older, more primitive order of being met him on his travels. He inhaled whatever remained of the earth's original sweetness and power, whatever was left of qualities we might once have shared with the territories. Even when he approached some human dwelling, even while he snapped the backbone of the family mutt and tore the dog into gristly rags he swallowed whole, Wolf was aware of pure, cool streams moving far beneath the ground, of bright snow on a mountain somewhere a long way west. This seemed a perfect place for a transmogrified wolf, and if he had killed any human being, he would have been damned. He killed no people. He saw none, and perhaps that is why. During the 3 days of his change, Wolf did kill and devour representatives of most other forms of life to be found in eastern Indiana, including one skunk and an entire family of bobcats living in limestone caves on a hillside 2 valleys away. On his first night in the woods, he caught a low-flying bat in his jaws, bit off its head, and swallowed the rest while it was still jerking. Whole squadrons of domestic cats went down his throat, platoons of dogs. With a wild, concentrated glee, he one night slaughtered every pig in a pen the size of a city block. But twice Wolf found that he was mysteriously forbidden from killing his prey, and this too made him feel at home in the world through which he prowled. It was a question of place, not of any abstract moral concern, and on the surface the places were merely ordinary. One was a clearing in the woods into which he had chased a rabbit, the other the scruffy backyard of a farmhouse where a whimpering dog lay chained to a stake. The instant he set a paw down in these places, his hackles rose and an electric tingling traversed the entire distance of his spine. These were sacred places, and in a sacred place a wolf could not kill. That was all. Like all hallowed sites, they had been set apart a long time ago, so long ago that the word ancient could have been used to describe them. Ancient is probably as close as we can come to representing the vast well of time. Wolf sensed about him in the farmer's backyard and the little clearing a dense envelope of years packed together in a small, highly charged location. Wolf simply backed off the sacred ground and took himself elsewhere. Like the wingmen Jack had seen, Wolf lived in a mystery, and so was comfortable with all such things. And he did not forget his obligations to Jack Sawyer. In the locked shed, Jack found himself thrown upon the properties of his own mind and character more starkly than at any other time in his life. The only furniture in the shed was the little wooden bench, the only distraction the nearly decade-old magazines, and these he could not actually read. Since there were no windows, except in very early morning when light came streaming under the door, he had trouble just working out the pictures on the pages. The words were streams of gray worms, indecipherable. He could not imagine how he would get through the next 3 days. Jack went toward the bench, struck it painfully with his knee, and sat down to think. One of the first things he realized was that shed time was different from time on the outside. Beyond the shed, seconds marched quickly past, melted into minutes which melted into hours. Whole days ticked along like metronomes, whole weeks. In shed time, the seconds obstinately refused to move. They stretched into grotesque monster seconds, plastic man seconds. Outside, an hour might go by, while 4 or 5 seconds swelled and bloated inside the shed. The second thing Jack realized was that thinking about the slowness of time made it worse. Once you started concentrating on the passing of seconds, they more or less refused to move at all. So he tried to pace off the dimensions of his cell, just to take his mind off the eternity of seconds it took to make up 3 days. Putting one foot in front of the other and counting his steps, he worked out that the shed was approximately 7 feet by 9 feet. At least there would be enough room for him to stretch out at night. If he walked all the way around the inside of the shed, he'd walk about 32 feet. If he walked around the inside of the shed 165 times, he'd cover a mile. He might not be able to eat, but he sure could walk. Jack took off his watch and put it in his pocket, promising himself that he would look at it only when he absolutely had to. He was about 1/4 of the way through his first mile when he remembered that there was no water in the shed. No food and no water. He supposed that it took longer than 3 or 4 days to die of thirst. As long as Wolf came back for him, he'd be all right. Well, maybe not all right, but at least alive. And if Wolf didn't come back, he would have to break the door down. In that case, he thought, he'd better try it now, while he still had some strength. Jack went to the door and pushed it with both hands. He pushed it harder, and the hinges squeaked. Experimentally, Jack threw his shoulder at the edge of the door, opposite the hinges. He hurt his shoulder, but he didn't think he had done anything to the door. He banged his shoulder against the door more forcefully. The hinges squealed, but did not move a millimeter. Wolf could have torn the door off with one hand, but Jack did not think that he could move it if he turned his shoulders into hamburger by running into it. He would just have to wait for Wolf. By the middle of the night, Jack had walked 7 or 8 miles. He'd lost count of the number of times he had reached 165, but it was something like 7 or 8. He was parched, and his stomach was rumbling. The shed stank of urine, for Jack had been forced to pee against the far wall, where a crack in the boards meant that at least some of it went outside. His body was tired, but he did not think he could sleep. According to clock time, Jack had been in the shed barely 5 hours. In shed time, it was more like 24. He was afraid to lie down. His mind would not let him go. That was how it felt. He had tried making lists of all the books he'd read in the past year, of every teacher he'd had, of every player on the Los Angeles Dodgers, but disturbing, disorderly images kept breaking in. He kept seeing Morgan Sloat tearing a hole in the air. Wolf's face floated underwater and his hands drifted down like heavy weeds. Jerry Bledsoe twitched and rocked before the electrical panel, his glasses smeared over his nose. A man's eyes turned yellow and his hand became a claw hoof. Uncle Tommy's false teeth coruscated in the Sunset Strip gutter. Morgan Sloat came toward him, his bald scalp suddenly rippling with black hair. But then Uncle Morgan was coming toward his mother, not himself. "Songs by Fats Waller," he said, sending himself around another circuit in the dark. "Your feet's too big. Ain't misbehavin'. Jitterbug waltz. Keepin' out of mischief now." The Elroy thing reached out toward his mother, whispering lewdly, and clamped a hand down over her hip. "Countries in Central America, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, Costa Rica." Even when he was so tired, he finally had to lie down and curl into a ball on the floor, using his knapsack as a pillow. Elroy and Morgan Sloat rampaged through his mind. Osmond flicked his bullwhip across Lily Cavanaugh's back, and his eyes danced. Wolf reared up, massive, absolutely inhuman, and caught a rifle bullet directly in the heart. The first light woke him, and he smelled blood. His whole body begged for water, then for food. Jack groaned. 3 more nights of this would be impossible to survive. The low angle of the sunlight allowed him dimly to see the walls and roof of the shed. It all looked larger than he had felt it to be last night. He had to pee again, though he could scarcely believe that his body could afford to give up any moisture. Finally, he realized that the shed seemed larger because he was lying on the floor. Then he smelled blood again and looked sideways toward the door. The skinned hindquarters of a rabbit had been thrust through the gap. They lay sprawled on the rough boards, leaking blood, glistening. Smudges of dirt and a long, ragged scrape showed that they had been forced into the shed. Wolf was trying to feed him. "Oh, jeez," Jack groaned. The rabbit's stripped legs were disconcertingly human. Jack's stomach folded into itself. But instead of vomiting, he laughed, startled by an absurd comparison. Wolf was like the family pet who each morning presents his owners with a dead bird, an eviscerated mouse. With 2 fingers, Jack delicately picked up the horrible offering and deposited it under the bench. He still felt like laughing, but his eyes were wet. Wolf had survived the first night of his transformation, and so had Jack. The next morning brought an absolutely anonymous, almost ovoid knuckle of meat around a startlingly white bone splintered at both ends. On the morning of the 4th day, Jack heard someone sliding down into the gully. A startled bird squawked, then noisily lifted itself off the roof of the shed. Heavy footsteps advanced toward the door. Jack raised himself onto his elbows and blinked into the darkness. A large body thudded against the door and stayed there. A pair of split and stained penny loafers was visible through the gap. "Wolf?" Jack asked softly. "That's you, isn't it?"
"Give me the key, Jack."
Jack slipped his hand into his pocket, brought out the key, and pushed it directly between the penny loafers. A large brown hand dropped into view and picked up the key.
"Bring any water?" Jack asked.
Despite what he had been able to extract from Wolf's gruesome presence, he had come close to serious dehydration. His lips were puffy and cracked, and his tongue felt swollen, baked. The key slid into the lock, and Jack heard it click open. Then the lock came away from the door.
"A little," Wolf said. "Close your eyes, Jackie. You have night eyes now."
Jack clasped his hands over his eyes as the door opened, but the light which boomed and thundered into the shed still managed to trickle through his fingers and stab his eyes. He hissed with the pain.
"Better soon," Wolf said, very close to him.
Wolf's arms circled and lifted him.
"Eyes closed," Wolf warned, and stepped backward out of the shed.
Even as Jack said, "Water," and felt the rusty lip of an old cup meet his own lips, he knew why Wolf had not lingered in the shed. The air outside seemed unbelievably fresh and sweet. It might have been imported directly from the territories. He sucked in a double tablespoon of water that tasted like the best meal on earth and wound down through him like a sparkling little river, reviving everything it touched. He felt as though he were being irrigated. Wolf removed the cup from his lips long before Jack considered he was through with it.
"If I give you more, you'll just sick it up," Wolf said. "Open your eyes, Jack, but only a little bit."
Jack followed directions. A million particles of light stormed into his eyes. He cried out. Wolf sat down, cradling Jack in his arms.
"Sip," he said, and put the cup once more to Jack's lips. "Eyes open, little more."
Now the sunlight hurt much less. Jack peered out through the screen of his eyelashes at a flaring dazzle, while another miraculous trickle of water slipped down his throat.
"Ah," Jack said, "what makes water so delicious?"
"The western wind," Wolf promptly replied.
Jack opened his eyes wider. The swarm and dazzle resolved into the weathered brown of the shed and the mixed green and lighter brown of the gully. His head rested against Wolf's shoulder, the bulge of Wolf's stomach pressed into his backbone.
"Are you okay, Wolf?" he asked. "Did you get enough to eat?"
"Wolves always get enough to eat," Wolf said simply.
He patted the boy's thigh.
"Thanks for bringing me those pieces of meat."
"I promised. You were the herd, remember?"
"Oh, yes, I remember," Jack said. "Can I have some more of that water?"
He slid off Wolf's huge lap and sat on the ground where he could face him.
Wolf handed him the cup. The John Lennon glasses were back. Wolf's beard was now little more than a scurf covering his cheeks.
His black hair, though still long and greasy, fell well short of his shoulders. Wolf's face was friendly and peaceful, almost tired-looking. Over the bib overalls he wore a gray sweatshirt about two sizes too small, with Indiana University Athletic Department stenciled on the front. He looked more like an ordinary human being than at any other time since he and Jack had met. He did not look as if he could have made it through the simplest college course, but he could have been a great high school football player. Jack sipped again. Wolf's hand hovered above the rusty tin cup, ready to snatch it away if Jack gulped.
"You're really okay?"
"Right here and now," Wolf said.
He rubbed his other hand over his belly, so distended that it stretched the fabric at the bottom of the sweatshirt as taut as a hand would a rubber glove.
"Just tired. Little sleep, Jack. Right here and now."
"Where'd you get the sweatshirt?"
"It was hanging on a line," Wolf said. "Cold here, Jackie."
"You didn't hurt any people, did you?"
"No people, Wolf. Drink that water, slow now."
His eyes disconcertingly shaded into happy Halloween orange for a second, and Jack saw that Wolf could never really be said to resemble an ordinary human being. Then Wolf opened his wide mouth and yawned.
"Little sleep."
He hitched himself into a more comfortable position on the slope and put down his head. He was almost immediately asleep. Part 3. A Collision of Worlds. Chapter 20. Taken by the Law. By 2 o'clock that afternoon, they were 100 miles west, and Jack Sawyer felt as if he, too, had been running with the moon. It had gone that easily. In spite of his extreme hunger, Jack sipped slowly at the water in the rusty can and waited for Wolf to awaken. Finally, Wolf stirred, said, "Ready now, Jack," hitched the boy up onto his back, and trotted into Daleville. While Wolf sat outside on the curb and tried to look inconspicuous, Jack entered the Daleville Burger King. He made himself go first to the men's room and stripped to the waist. Even in the bathroom, the maddening smell of grilling meat caused the saliva to spill into his mouth. He washed his hands, arms, chest, face. Then he stuck his head under the tap and washed his hair with liquid soap. Crumpled paper towels fell, one after the other, to the floor. At last he was ready to go to the counter. The uniformed girl there stared at him while he gave his order. His wet hair, he thought. While she waited for the order to come through, the girl stepped back and leaned against the service hatch, still unabashedly looking at him. He was biting into the first Whopper as he turned away toward the glass doors. Juice ran down his chin. He was so hungry he could scarcely bother to chew. 3 enormous bites took most of the big sandwich. He had just worked his mouth far enough around the remainder to take a fourth, when he saw through the doors that Wolf had attracted a crowd of children. The meat congealed in his mouth, and his stomach slammed shut. Jack hurried outside, still trying to swallow his mouthful of ground chuck, limp bread, pickles, lettuce, tomatoes, and sauce. The kids stood in the street on 3 sides of Wolf, staring at him every bit as frankly as the waitress had stared at Jack. Wolf had hunched down on the curb as far as he was able, bowing his back and pulling in his neck like a turtle. His ears seemed flattened against his head. The wad of food stuck in Jack's throat like a golf ball,
and when he swallowed convulsively it dropped down another notch. Wolf glanced at him out of the side of his eye and visibly relaxed. A tall, blue-jeaned man in his 20s opened the door of a battered red pickup 5 or 6 feet away down the curb, leaned against the cab, and watched, smiling. "Have a burger, Wolf," Jack said as carelessly as he could. He handed Wolf the box, which Wolf sniffed. Then Wolf lifted his head and took a huge bite out of the box. He began methodically to chew. Children, astounded and fascinated, stepped nearer. A few of them were giggling. "What is he?" asked a little girl with blonde pigtails tied with fuzzy pink gift-wrapping yarn. "Is he a monster?" A crew-cut boy of 7 or 8 shoved himself in front of the girl and said, "He's the Hulk, isn't he? He's really the Hulk, hey? Hey? Huh? Right?" Wolf had managed to extract what was left of his Whopper from its cardboard container. He pushed the whole thing into his mouth with his palm. Shreds of lettuce fell between his upraised knees, mayonnaise and meat juices smeared over his chin, his cheek. Everything else became a brownish pulp, smacked to death between Wolf's enormous teeth. When he swallowed, he started to lick the inside of the box. Jack gently took the container out of his hands. "No, he's just my cousin. He's not a monster, and he's not the Hulk. Why don't you kids get away and leave us alone, huh? Go on, leave us alone." They continued to stare. Wolf was now licking his fingers. "If you keep on gawping at him like that, you might make him mad. I don't know what he'd do if he got mad." The boy with the crew cut had seen David Banner's transformation often enough to have an idea of what anger might do to this monstrous Burger King carnivore. He stepped back. Most of the others moved back with him. "Go on, please," Jack said, but the children had frozen again. Wolf rose up mountainously, his fists clenched. "God pound you, don't look at me," he bellowed. "Don't make me feel funny. Everybody makes me feel funny." The children scattered. Breathing hard, red-faced, Wolf stood and watched them disappear up Daleville's main street and around the corner. When they were gone, he wrapped his arms around his chest and looked dartingly at Jack. He was miserable with embarrassment. "Wolf shouldn't have yelled," he said. "They were just little ones." "Big fat scare'll do 'em a lot of good," a voice said, and Jack saw that the young man from the red pickup was still leaning against his cab, smiling at them. "Never saw anything like that before myself. Cousins, are you?" Jack nodded suspiciously. "Hey, I didn't mean to get personal or anything." He stepped forward, an easy, dark-haired young man in a sleeveless down vest and a plaid shirt. "I especially don't want to make anybody feel funny now, you know." He paused, lifted his hands, palm out. "Really? I was just thinking that you guys look like you've been on the road a while." Jack glanced at Wolf, who was still hugging himself in embarrassment, but also glowering through his round glasses at this figure. "I've been there myself," the man said. "Hey, dig it. The year I got out of good old DHS, Daleville High, you know, I hitched all the way to Northern California and all the way back. Anyhow, if you're sort of going west, I can give you a lift."
"Can't, Jackie," Wolf spoke in a thunderous stage whisper.
"How far west?" Jack asked. "We're trying to make it to Springfield. I have a friend in Springfield." "Hey, no problema, senor," he raised his hands again. "I'm going just this side of Cayuga, right next to the Illinois border. You let me scarf a burger, we gone. Straight shot. 1.5 hours, maybe less. You'll be about halfway to Springfield."
"Can't," Wolf rasped again.
"There's one problem, okay? I got some stuff on the front seat. One of you guys will have to ride behind. It's going to be windy back there." "You don't know how great that is," Jack said, speaking nothing more than the truth. "We'll see you when you come back out." Wolf began to dance in agitation. "Honest, we'll be out here, mister, and thanks."
He turned to whisper to Wolf as soon as the man went through the doors. And so when the young man, Bill Buck Thompson, for that was his name, returned to his pickup carrying the containers for 2 more Whoppers,
He found a sedate-looking wolf kneeling in the open back, his arms resting on the side panel, mouth open, nose already lifting. Jack was in the passenger seat, crowded by a stack of bulky plastic bags, which had been taped, then stapled shut, and then sprayed extensively with room freshener, to judge by the smell. Through the translucent sides of the bags were visible long, frond-like cuttings, medium green. Clusters of buds grew on these amputated fronds. "I reckoned you still looked a little hungry," he said, and tossed another whopper to Wolf. Then he let himself in on the driver's side across the pile of plastic bags from Jack. "Thought he might catch it in his teeth. No reflection on your cousin. Here, take this one. He already pulverized his." And 100 miles west they went, Wolf delirious with joy to have the wind whipping past his head, half hypnotized by the speed and variety of the odors which his nose caught in flight. Eyes blazing and glowing, registering every nuance of the wind, Wolf twitched from side to side behind the cab, shoving his nose into the speeding air. Buck Thompson spoke of himself as a farmer. He talked non-stop during the 75 minutes he kept his foot near the floor, and never once asked Jack any questions. And when he swung off onto a narrow dirt road just outside the Cayuga town line and stopped the car beside a cornfield that seemed to run for miles, he dug in his shirt pocket and brought out a faintly irregular cigarette, rolled in an almost tissue-like white paper. "I've heard of Red Eye," he said, "but your cousin's ridiculous." He dropped the cigarette into Jack's hand. "Have him take some of this when he gets excited, will you? Doctor's orders." Jack absently stuffed the joint into his shirt pocket and climbed out of the cab. "Thanks, Buck," he called up to the driver. "Man, I thought I'd seen something when I saw him eat," Buck said. "How'd he get him to go places? Yell mush, mush at him?" Once Wolf realized that the ride was over, he bounded off the back of the truck. The red pickup rolled off, leaving a long plume of dust behind it. "Let's do that again!" Wolf sang out. "Jackie, let's do that again!" "Boy, I wish we could," Jack said. "Come on, let's walk for a while. Someone will probably come along." He was thinking that his luck had turned, that in no time at all he and Wolf would be over the border into Illinois, and he'd always been certain that things would go smoothly once he got to Springfield and Thayer School and Richard. But Jack's mind was still partially in shed time, where what is unreal bloats and distorts whatever is real, and when the bad things started to happen again, they happened so quickly that he was unable to control them. It was a long time before Jack saw Illinois, and during that time, he found himself back in the shed. The bewilderingly rapid series of events which led to the Sunlight home began 10 minutes after the two boys had walked past the stark little road sign telling them that they were now in Cayuga, population 23,568. Cayuga itself was nowhere visible. To their right, the endless cornfield rolled across the land. To their left, a bare field allowed them to see how the road bent, then arrowed straight toward the flat horizon. Just after Jack had realized that they would probably have to walk all the way into town to get their next ride, a car appeared on this road, traveling fast toward them. "Riding back?" Wolf yelled, joyfully raising his arms up over his head. "Wolf riding back, right here and now!" "It's going the wrong way," Jack said. "Just be calm and let it pass us, Wolf. Get your arms down, or he'll think you're signaling him." Reluctantly, Wolf lowered his arms. The car had come nearly to the bend in the road, which would take it directly past Jack and Wolf. "No ride in the back now?" Wolf asked, pouting almost childishly. Jack shook his head. He was staring at an oval medallion painted on the car's dusty white door panel. County Parks Commission, this might have said, or State Wildlife Board. It might have been anything from the vehicle of the state agricultural agent to the property of the Cayuga Maintenance Department. But when it turned into the bend, Jack saw it was a police car. "That's a cop, Wolf, a policeman. Just keep walking and stay nice and loose. We don't want him to stop."
"What's a coppiceman?"
Wolf's voice had dropped into a dark brown range. He had seen that the speeding car was now coming straight toward him.
"Does a coppiceman kill wolves?"
"No," Jack said. "They absolutely never kill wolves." But it did no good. Wolf captured Jack's hand in his own, which trembled.
"Let go of me, please, Wolf," Jack pleaded. "He'll think it's funny."
Wolf's hand dropped away. As the police car advanced toward them, Jack glanced at the figure behind the wheel, and then turned around and walked back a few paces so that he could watch Wolf. What he had seen was not encouraging. The policeman driving the car had a wide, doughy, domineering face with livid slabs of fat where he'd once had cheekbones. And Wolf's terror was plain on his face. Eyes, nostrils flared. He was showing his teeth.
"You really liked riding in the back of that truck, didn't you?" Jack asked him.
Some of the terror disappeared, and Wolf nearly managed a smile. The police car roared past. Jack was conscious of the driver turning his head to inspect them.
"All right," Jack said. "He's on his way. We're okay, Wolf."
He had turned around again when he heard the sound of the police car suddenly begin to grow louder again.
"Coppiceman's coming back!"
"Probably just going back to Cayuga," Jack said. "Turn around and just act like me. Don't stare at him."
Wolf and Jack trudged along, pretending to ignore the car, which seemed to hang behind them deliberately. Wolf uttered a sound that was half moan, half howl. The police car swung out into the road, passed them, flashed its brake lights, and then cut in diagonally before them. The officer pushed open his door and got his feet planted on the ground. Then he hoisted himself out of the seat. He was roughly Jack's height, and all his weight was in his face and his stomach. His legs were twig skinny, his arms and shoulders those of a normally developed man. His gut, trussed in the brown uniform like a 15-pound turkey, bulged out on both sides of the wide brown belt.
"I can't wait for it," he said, and cocked an arm and leaned on the open door. "What's your story, anyhow? Give!"
Wolf padded up behind Jack and hunched his shoulders, his hands shoved deep into the pockets of his overalls.
"We're going to Springfield, officer," Jack said. "We've been hitching. I guess maybe we shouldn't."
"You guess maybe you shouldn't. Holy shit, what's this guy trying to disappear behind you, a Wookiee?"
"He's my cousin." Jack thought frantically for a moment. The story had to be bent far enough to accommodate Wolf. "I'm supposed to be taking him home. He lives in Springfield with his Aunt Helen. I mean, my Aunt Helen, the one who's a schoolteacher in Springfield."
"What did he do, escape from somewhere?"
No, nothing like that. It was just that..."
The cop looked at him neutrally, his face sizzling.
"Names?"
Now the boy met a dilemma. Wolf was certain to call him Jack, no matter what name he gave the cop.
"I'm Jack Parker," he said. "And he's hold it. I want the Phoebe to tell me himself. Come on, you. You remember your name, basket case?"
Wolf squirmed behind Jack, digging his chin into the top of his overalls. He muttered something.
"I couldn't hear you, sonny."
"Wolf," he whispered.
"Wolf. Probably I should have guessed. What's your first name, or did they just give you a number?"
Wolf had squeezed his eyes shut and was twisting his legs together.
"Come on, Phil," Jack said, thinking that it was one of the few names Wolf might remember. But he had just finished it when Wolf pulled up his head and straightened his back and yelled, "Jack! Jack! Jack Wolf!"
"We call him Jack sometimes," the boy put in, knowing it was already too late. "It's because he likes me so much. Sometimes I'm the only one who can do anything with him. I might even stay there in Springfield a few days after I get him home just to make sure he settles down okay."
"I sure am sick of the sound of your voice, Jack boy. Why don't you and good old Phil Jack get in the back seat here and we'll go into town and straighten everything out?"
When Jack did not move, the policeman put a hand on the butt of the enormous pistol which hung from his straining belt.
"Get in the car. Him first. I want to find out why you're 100 miles from home on a school day. In the car, right now."
"Officer,"
Jack began, and behind him Wolf rasped, "No, can't."
"My cousin has this problem," Jack said. "He's claustrophobic. Small spaces, especially the insides of cars, drive him crazy. We can only get rides in pickups, so he can be in the back."
"Get in the car," the policeman said.
He stepped forward and opened the back door.
"Can't," Wolf wailed. "Wolf can't! Stinks, Jackie, it stinks in there."
His nose and lip had wrinkled into corrugations.
"You get him in the car, or I will," the cop said to Jack.
"Wolf, it won't be for long," Jack said, reaching for Wolf's hand. Reluctantly, Wolf allowed him to take it. Jack pulled him toward the back seat of the police car, Wolf literally dragging his feet across the surface of the road. For a couple of seconds, it looked as though it would work. Wolf got close enough to the police car to touch the door frame. Then his entire body shook. He clamped both hands onto the top of the door frame. It looked as though he were going to try to rip the top of the car in half, as a circus strongman tears a telephone book in two.
"Please," Jack said quietly, "we have to." But Wolf was terrified and too disgusted by whatever he had smelled. He shook his head violently. Slobber ran from his mouth and dripped onto the top of the car. The policeman stepped around Jack and released something from a catch on his belt. Jack had time only to see that it was not his pistol before the cop expertly whapped his blackjack into the base of Wolf's skull. Wolf's upper body dropped onto the top of the car, and then all of Wolf slid gracefully down onto the dusty road.
"You get on his other side," the cop said, fastening the sap to his belt. "We're finally going to get this big bag of shit into the vehicle."
2 or 3 minutes later, after they had twice dropped Wolf's heavy, unconscious body back onto the road, they were speeding toward Cayuga.
"I already know what's going to happen to you and your feeb cousin, if he is your cousin, which I doubt."
The cop looked up at Jack in his rearview mirror, and his eyes were raisins dipped in fresh tar. All the blood in Jack's body seemed to swing down, down in his veins, and his heart jumped in his chest. He had remembered the cigarette in his shirt pocket. He clapped his hand over it, then jerked his hand away before the cop could say anything.
"I gotta put his shoes back on," Jack said. "They sort of fell off."
"Forget it," the cop said, but did not object further when Jack bent over. Out of sight of the mirror, he first shoved one of the split-seamed loafers back up on Wolf's bare heel, then quickly snatched the joint out of his pocket and popped it in his mouth. He bit into it, and dry, crumbly particles with an oddly herbal taste spilled over his tongue. Jack began to grind them between his teeth. Something scratched down into his throat, and he convulsively jerked upright, put his hand in front of his mouth, and tried to cough with his lips together. When his throat was clear, he hurriedly swallowed all of the dampened, now rather sludgy, marijuana. Jack ran his tongue over his teeth, collecting all the flecks and traces.
"You got a few surprises ahead of you," the policeman said. "You're going to get a little sunlight in your soul."
"Sunlight in my soul?" Jack asked, thinking that the cop had seen him stuff the joint into his mouth.
"A few blisters on your hands, too," the cop said, and glared happily at Jack's guilty image in the rearview mirror.
The Cayuga Municipal Building was a shadowy maze of unlighted hallways and narrow staircases that seemed to wind unexpectedly upward alongside equally narrow rooms. Water sang and rumbled in the pipes.
"Let me explain something to you kids," the policeman said, ushering them toward the last staircase to their right. "You're not under arrest. Got that? You are being detained for questioning. I don't want to hear any bullshit about one phone call. You're in limbo until you tell us who you are and what you're up to," the cop went on. "You hear me? Limbo. Nowhere. We're going to see Judge Fairchild. He's the magistrate, and if you don't tell us the truth, you're going to pay some big fucking consequences. Upstairs. Move it."
At the top of the stairs, the policeman pushed a door open. A middle-aged woman in wire glasses and a black dress looked up from a typewriter placed sideways against the far wall.
"Two more runaways," the policeman said. "Tell him we're here."
She nodded, picked up her telephone, and spoke a few words. "You may go in," the secretary said to them, her eyes wandering from Wolf to Jack and back again. The cop pushed them across the anteroom and opened the door to a room twice as large, lined with books on one long wall, framed photographs and diplomas and certificates on another. Blinds had been lowered across the long windows opposite. A tall, skinny man in a dark suit, a wrinkled white shirt, and a narrow tie of no discernible pattern stood up behind a chipped wooden desk that must have been 6 feet long. The man's face was a relief map of wrinkles, and his hair was so black it must have been dyed. Stale cigarette smoke hung visibly in the air.
"Well, what have we got here, Frankie?"
His voice was startlingly deep, almost theatrical. "Kids I picked up on French Lick Road over by Thompson's place." Judge Fairchild's wrinkles contorted into a smile as he looked at Jack.
"You have any identification papers on you, son?"
"No, sir," Jack said.
"Have you told Officer Williams here the truth about everything? He doesn't think you have, or you wouldn't be here."
"Yes, sir," Jack said.
"Then tell me your story."
He walked around his desk, disturbing the flat layers of smoke just over his head, and half sat, half leaned on the front corner nearest Jack. Squinting, he lit a cigarette. Jack saw the judge's recessed, pale eyes peering at him through the smoke, and knew there was no charity in them. It was the pitcher plant again. Jack drew in a large breath. "My name is Jack Parker. He's my cousin, and he's called Jack, too, Jack Wolf, but his real name is Philip. He was staying with us in Daleville because his dad's dead and his mother got sick. I was just taking him back to Springfield."
"Simple-minded, is he?"
"A little slow," Jack said, and glanced up at Wolf. His friend seemed barely conscious.
"What's your mother's name?"
the judge asked Wolf. Wolf did not respond in any way. His eyes were clamped shut and his hands stuffed into his pockets. "She's named Helen," Jack said. "Helen Vaughn." The judge eased himself off the desk and walked slowly over to Jack.
"Have you been drinking, son? You're a little unsteady."
"No."
Judge Fairchild came to within a foot of Jack and bent down. "Let me smell your breath."
Jack opened his mouth and exhaled.
"Nope, no booze."
The judge straightened up again.
"But that's the only thing you were telling the truth about, isn't it? You're trying to string me along, boy."
"I'm sorry we were hitching," Jack said, aware that he had to speak with great caution now. Not only might what he said determine whether he and Wolf were to be let free, but he was having a little trouble forming the words themselves. Everything seemed to be happening with great slowness. As in the shed, the seconds had wandered off the metronome. "In fact, we hardly ever hitch, because Wolf—Jack, that is—hates being in cars. We'll never do it again. We haven't done anything wrong, sir, and that really is the truth."
"You don't understand, sonny," the judge said, and his far-off eyes gleamed again.
"He's enjoying this," Jack understood. Judge Fairchild moved slowly back behind his desk.
"Hitching rides isn't the issue. You two boys are out on the road by yourself, coming from nowhere, going nowhere, real targets for trouble."
His voice was like dark honey.
"Now, we have here in this county what we think is a most unusual facility, state-approved and state-funded, by the way, which might have been set up expressly for the benefit of boys like yourselves. It's called the Sunlight Gardner Scripture Home for Wayward Boys. Mr. Gardner's work with young fellows in trouble has been nothing short of miraculous. We've sent him some tough cases, and in no time at all he has those boys on their knees begging Jesus for forgiveness. Now, I'd say that was pretty special, wouldn't you?"
Jack swallowed. His mouth felt drier than it had been in the shed.
Sir, it's really urgent that we get to Springfield. Everybody's going to wonder—"
"I very much doubt that," said the judge, smiling with all his wrinkles. "But I'll tell you what. As soon as you two wags are on your way to the Sunlight Home, I'll telephone Springfield and try to get the number of this Helen—Wolf, is it?
Or is it Helen Vaughn?
Vaughn, Jack said, and a red-hot blush covered his face like a fever.
Yes, the judge said.
Wolf shook his head, blinking, and then put a hand on Jack's shoulder.
Coming around, are you, son? The judge asked. Could you tell me your age?
Wolf blinked again and looked at Jack.
16, Jack said.
And you?
12.
Oh, I would have taken you for several years older. All the more reason for seeing you get help now, before you get in real deep trouble. Wouldn't you say, Frankie?
Amen, the policeman said.
You boys come back here in a month, said the judge. Then we'll see if your memory is any better. Why are your eyes so bloodshot?
They feel kind of funny, Jack said, and the policeman barked. He had laughed, Jack realized, a second later.
Take them away, Frankie, the judge said. He was already picking up the telephone. You're going to be different boys 30 days from now, depend on it.
While they walked down the steps of the red brick municipal building, Jack asked Frankie Williams why the judge had asked for their ages. The cop paused on the bottom step and half-turned to glare up at Jack out of his blazing face.
Old Sunlight generally takes him in at 12 and turns him loose at 19.
He grinned.
You telling me you never heard him on the radio? He's about the most famous thing we got around here. I'm pretty sure they heard of old Sunlight Gardner even way over in Daleville.
His teeth were small, discolored pegs, irregularly spaced. 20 minutes later, they were in farmland again. Wolf had climbed into the back seat of the police car with surprisingly little fuss. Frankie Williams had pulled his sap from his belt and said, "You want this again, you fucking freak? Who knows, it might make you smart." Wolf had trembled. Wolf's nose had wrinkled up, but he had followed Jack into the car. He had immediately clapped his hand over his nose and begun breathing through his mouth.
"We'll get away from this place, Wolf," Jack had whispered into his ear. "A couple of days, that's all, and we'll see how to do it."
"No chatter," came from the front seat.
Jack was strangely relaxed. He was certain they would find a way to escape. He leaned back against the plastic seat, Wolf's hand wrapped around his, and watched the fields go by.
"There she is," Frankie Williams called from the front seat. "Your future home."
Jack saw a meeting of tall brick walls planted surrealistically amidst the fields. Too tall to see over, the walls around the Sunlight home were topped with 3 strands of barbed wire and shards of broken glass set in cement. The car was now driving past exhausted fields bordered with fences in which strands of barbed and smooth wire alternated.
"Got 60 acres out here," Williams said, "and all of it is either walled or fenced. You better believe it. Boys did it themselves."
A wide iron gate interrupted the expanse of wall where the drive turned into the home's property. As soon as the police car turned into the drive, the gate swung open, triggered by some electronic signal.
"TV camera," the policeman explained. "They're a-waiting for you two fresh fish."
Jack leaned forward and put his face to the window. Boys in denim jackets worked in the long fields to either side, hoeing and raking, pushing wheelbarrows.
"You two shitheads just earned me $20, Williams said, "plus another 20 for Judge Fairchild. Ain't that great?"
Chapter 21. The Sunlight Home. The home looked like something made from child's blocks, Jack thought. It had grown randomly as more space was needed. Then he saw that the numerous windows were barred, and the sprawling building immediately seemed penal rather than childish. Most of the boys in the fields had put down their tools to watch the progress of the police car. Frankie Williams pulled up into the wide, rounded end of the drive. As soon as he had cut off his engine, a tall figure stepped through the front door and stood regarding them from the top of the steps, his hands knitted together before him. Beneath a full head of longish, wavy white hair, the man's face seemed unrealistically youthful.
as if these chipped, vitally masculine features had been created, or at least assisted, by plastic surgery. It was the face of a man who could sell anything, anywhere, to anybody. His clothes were as white as his hair, white suit, white shoes, white shirt, and a trailing white silk scarf around his neck. As Jack and Wolf got out of the back seat, the man in white pulled a pair of dark green sunglasses from his suit pocket, put them on, and appeared to examine the two boys for a moment before smiling. Long creases split his cheeks. Then he removed the sunglasses and put them back in his pocket.
"Well," he said, "well, well, well. Where would we all be without you, Officer Williams?"
"Afternoon, Reverend Gardner," the policeman said. "Is it the usual sort of thing, or were these two bold fellows actually engaged in criminal activity?"
"Vagrants," said the cop. Hands on hips, he squinted up at Gardner as if all that whiteness hurt his eyes.
"Refused to give Fairchild their right names. This one, the big one," he said, pointing a thumb at Wolf, "he wouldn't talk at all. I had to nail him in the head just to get him in the car."
Gardner shook his head tragically. "Why don't you bring them up here so they can introduce themselves, and then we'll take care of the various formalities. Is there any reason why the two of them should look so, shall we say, befuddled?"
"Just that I cracked that big one behind the ears."
Gardner stepped backward, steepling his fingers before his chest. As Williams prodded the boys up the steps to the long porch, Gardner cocked his head and regarded his new arrivals. Jack and Wolf reached the top of the steps and moved tentatively onto the surface of the porch. Frankie Williams wiped his forehead and huffed himself up beside them. Gardner was smiling mistily, but his eyes switched back and forth between the boys. The second after something hard, cold, and familiar jumped out of his eyes at Jack, the Reverend again twitched the sunglasses out of his pocket and put them on. The smile remained misty and delicate, but even wrapped as he was in a sense of false security, Jack felt frozen by that glance, because he had seen it before. Reverend Gardner pulled the sunglasses below the bridge of his nose and peered playfully over the tops of the frames. "Names, names? Might we have some names from you two gentlemen?"
"I'm Jack," the boy said, and then stopped. He did not want to say one word more until he had to. Reality seemed to fold and buckle about Jack for a moment. He felt that he had been jerked back into the territories, but that now the territories were evil and threatening, and that foul smoke, jumping flames, and screams of tortured bodies filled the air. A powerful hand closed over his elbow and held him upright. Instead of the foulness and smoke, Jack smelled some heavy, sweet cologne, applied too liberally. A pair of melancholy gray eyes were looking directly into his.
"And have you been a bad boy, Jack? Have you been a very bad boy?"
"No. We were just hitching, and I think you're a trifle stoned," said the Reverend Gardner. "We'll have to see that you get some special attention, won't we?" The hand released his elbow. Gardner stepped neatly away and pushed the sunglasses up over his eyes again. "You do possess a last name, I imagine."
"Parker," Jack said.
"Yes."
Gardner whipped the glasses off his head, executed a dancing little half-turn, and was scrutinizing Wolf. He had given no indication whether he believed Jack or not.
"My," he said, "you're a healthy specimen, aren't you? Positively strapping. We'll certainly be able to find a use for a big, strong boy like you around here, praise the Lord. And might I ask you to emulate Mr. Jack Parker here and give me your name?"
Jack looked uneasily at Wolf. His head was bowed, and he was breathing heavily. A glistening line of slobber went from the corner of his mouth to his chin. A black smudge, half dirt, half grease, covered the front of the stolen athletic department sweatshirt. Wolf shook his head, but the gesture seemed to have no content. He might have been shaking away a fly.
Name, son? Name, name? Are you called Bill, Paul, Art, Sammy?
No, something exceedingly foursquare, I'm sure. George, perhaps.
Wolf, said Wolf.
Ah, that is nice.
Gardner beamed at both of them.
Mr. Parker and Mr. Wolf.
Perhaps you'll escort them inside, Officer Williams. And aren't we happy that Mr. Bast is in residence already? For the presence of Mr. Hector Bast, one of our stewards, by the way, means that we shall probably be able to outfit Mr. Wolf.
He peered at the two boys over the frames of his sunglasses.
One of our beliefs here at the Scripture Home is that the soldiers of the Lord march best when they march in uniform. And Heck Bast is nearly as large as your friend Wolf, young Jack Parker. So from the points of view of both clothing and discipline, you shall be very well served indeed. A comfort, yes.
Jack, Wolf said in a low voice.
Yes.
My head hurts, Jack. Hurts bad.
Your little head pains you, Mr. Wolf. Reverend Sunlight Gardner half-danced toward Wolf and gently patted his arm. Wolf snatched his arm away, his face working into an exaggerated reflex of disgust. The cologne, Jack knew, that heavy, cloying odor would have been like ammonia in Wolf's sensitive nostrils.
"Never mind, son," said Gardner, seemingly unaffected by Wolf's withdrawal from him. "Mr. Bast or Mr. Singer, our other steward, will see to that inside. Frank, I thought I told you to get them into the home."
Officer Williams reacted as if he had been jabbed in the back with a pin. His face grew more feverish, and he jerked his peculiar body across the porch to the front door. Sunlight Gardner twinkled at Jack again, and the boy saw that all his dandified animation was only a kind of sterile self-amusement. The man in white was cold and crazy within. A heavy gold chain rattled out of Gardner's sleeve and came to rest against the base of his thumb. Jack heard the whistle of a whip cutting through the air, and this time he recognized Gardner's dark gray eyes. Gardner was Osmond's twinner.
"Inside, young fellows," Gardner said, half bowing and indicating the open door.
"By the way, Mr. Parker," Gardner said once they had gone in, "is it possible that we've met before? There must be some reason you look so familiar to me, mustn't there?"
"I don't know," Jack said, looking carefully around the odd interior of the Scripture Home. Long couches covered with a dark blue fabric sat against the wall on the forest green carpet. Two massive leather-topped desks had been placed against the opposite wall. At one of the desks, a pimply teenager glanced at them dully, then returned to the video screen before him, where a TV preacher was inveighing against rock and roll. The teenage boy seated at the adjoining desk straightened up and fixed Jack with an aggressive stare. He was slim and black-haired, and his narrow face looked clever and bad-tempered. To the pocket of his white turtleneck sweater was pinned a rectangular nameplate of the sort worn by soldiers— Singer.
"But I do think we have met each other somewhere, don't you, my lad? I assure you we must have. I don't forget. I am literally incapable of forgetting the face of a boy I have encountered. Have you ever been in trouble before this, Jack?"
Jack said, "I never saw you before."
Across the room, a massive boy had lifted himself off one of the blue couches and was now standing at attention. He, too, wore a white turtleneck sweater and a military nameplate. His hands wandered nervously from his sides to his belt, into the pockets of his blue jeans, back to his sides. He was at least 6'3" and seemed to weigh nearly 300 pounds. Acne burned across his cheeks and forehead. This clearly was Bast.
"Well, perhaps it will come to me later," Sunlight Gardner said.
"Heck, come up here and help our new arrivals at the desk, will you?" Bast lumbered forward, scowling. He made a point of coming up very close to Wolf before he sidestepped past him, scowling more fiercely all the while.
If Wolf had opened his eyes, which he did not, he would have seen no more than the ravaged moonscape of Bast's forehead and the mean, small eyes, like a bear's eyes, bulging up at him from beneath crusty brows. Bast switched his gaze to Jack, muttered, "Come on," and flapped a hand toward the desk.
"Registration, then take them up to the laundry for clothes," Gardner said in a flat voice.
He smiled with chrome-like brilliance at Jack.
"Jack Parker," he said softly. "I wonder who you really are, Jack Parker. Bast, make sure everything is out of his pockets."
Bast grinned. Sunlight Gardner drifted across the room toward an obviously impatient Frankie Williams and languidly withdrew a long leather wallet from his jacket's inside pocket. Jack saw him begin to count money out into the policeman's hands.
"Pay attention, snotface," said the boy behind the desk, and Jack snapped around to face him.
The boy was playing with a pencil, the smirk on his face an utterly inadequate disguise for what seemed to Jack's keyed-up perceptions his characteristic anger, a rage that bubbled far down within him, eternally stoked.
"Can he write?"
"Geez, I don't think so," Jack said.
"Then you'll have to sign in for him."
Singer shoved two legal-sized sheets of paper at him.
"Print on the top line, right on the bottom one, where the X's are."
He fell back into his chair, raising the pencil to his lips, and slumped eloquently into its corner. Jack supposed that was a trick learned from the very Reverend Sunlight Gardner.
"Jack Parker," he printed, and scrawled something like that at the bottom of the sheet.
"Philip Jack Wolfe," another scrawl even less like his real handwriting.
"Now you're wards of the state of Indiana, and that's what you'll be for the next 30 days, unless you decide to stay longer."
Singer twitched the papers back toward himself.
"You'll be decide?" Jack asked.
"What do you mean, decide?" A trifle of red grew smooth beneath Singer's cheeks. He jerked his head to one side and seemed to smile.
"I guess you don't know that over 60% of our kids are here voluntarily. It's possible, yeah, you could decide to stay here."
Jack tried to keep his face expressionless. Singer's mouth twitched violently, as if a fishhook had snagged it.
"This is a pretty good place, and if I ever hear you ranking it, I'll pound the shit out of you. It's the best place you've ever been in, I'm sure. I'll tell you another thing, you got no choice. You have to respect the Sunlight home, you understand?"
Jack nodded his head.
"How about him, does he?"
Jack looked up at Wolf, who was blinking slowly and breathing through his mouth.
"I think so." "All right. The two of you will be bunkmates. The day starts at 5 in the morning when we have chapel. Field work until 7, then breakfast in the dining hall. Back to the field until noon when we get lunch plus Bible readings. Everybody gets a crack at this, so you better start thinking about what you'll read. None of that sexy stuff from the Song of Songs either, unless you want to find out what discipline means. More work after lunch."
He looked sharply up at Jack.
"Hey, don't think that you work for nothing at the Sunlight home. Part of our arrangement with the state is that everybody gets a fair hourly wage, which is set against the cost of keeping you here. Clothes and food, electricity, heating, stuff like that. You are credited 50 cents an hour. That means you can earn $5 a day for the hours you put in, $30 a week. Sundays are spent in the Sunlight Chapel, except for the hour when we actually put on the Sunlight Gardner Gospel Hour."
The red smoothed itself out under the surface of his skin again, and Jack nodded in recognition, being more or less obliged to.
"If you turn out right, and if you can talk like a human being, which most people can't, then you might get a shot at OS, outside staff. We got two squads of OS, one that works the streets selling hymn sheets and flowers and Reverend Gardner's pamphlets, and the other one on duty at the airport. Anyhow, we got 30 days to turn you two scumbags around and make you see how dirty and filthy and diseased your crummy lives were before you came here. And this is where we start, right now, exactly.